Hello, and were you just whispering?
Yes, I was just whispering to Noe. Sorry. I was just whispering that if the cats become a problem, he should lock them out. I'm sorry.
Hello, and welcome to Dear Hank and John.
Or as I prefer to call it, Dear Mayim and Hank.
It's a comedy podcast where me and my brother John, but occasionally guest hosts like this week's Mayim Bialik, answer your questions, give you dubious advice, and bring you all the week's news from both Mars and AFC Wimbledon. Mayim, did you bring AFC Wimbledon news?
You know, I did, and it's big.
Oh, it's big. I looked up some, and I was like, oh, John's going to be sad he missed this week. How are you?
Oh, yeah, well, I'm okay, but, you know, AFC Wimbledon is really in goalkeeper shock.
Don't tell anyone yet. We have to save it for the end of the pod.
Okay. I'm doing okay.
Good. Where are you at?
I'm in my children's room. And I'm in Los Angeles.
Why are you in your children's? Is this where your podcast studio setup is?
It is. No, there's no studio to be had here. It's the quietest room in the house, as it were, because my children are not here.
Right. Yes, I would imagine that it's not usually the quietest room in the house.
No.
I have a child now. The last time we talked, I did not.
That's right. Congratulations again.
Now I do, and he's sleeping inside right now, and thus does not need me. So that's what I've heard is that if a child is sleeping, you can just leave, right, and go somewhere.
Oh yeah, no, they got that. Yeah. They figured that out.
Perfect. Thanks. This is excellent parenthood advice. I have a parenting question for you.
Okay.
Am I gonna be okay?
Are you gonna be okay? You will be okay. You'll be okay in about 4 years.
Okay. All right. Well, good. At least there's a horizon. I appreciate.
Yes.
I appreciate the perspective. Well, it's an absolute pleasure to have you here. It's very interesting to hear your voice. I assume that people know some things about you, but you obviously are on some TV shows and have been for a long time.
Right.
And also you are just sort of a professional, helpful nerd person on the internet. Is that right?
I guess. I mean, I definitely have made a sort of an active decision to find an audience that understands me as I am, since being an actor means having people like you for what they want you to be. And I started a website called Grok Nation, and I've started entering the YouTube space, honestly, completely inspired by you and your brother. To try and make an impact in positive ways that are helpful and entertaining and don't necessarily rely on a casting director telling you that you're good enough.
Yeah, I have done a little bit of the LA thing, and I don't really know why anyone would give up what I do for that.
Yes.
Just because it's rough. It's rough.
It's rough, and it's not like I work in the coal mines rough, but it is a...
Sure.
It is a psychologically and spiritually challenging environment to exist in. And, you know, I was in the industry as a child, and I left for 12 years and got my undergraduate and graduate degree. I had two kids, and I've returned, and The Big Bang Theory is a very big blessing in my life, but it was not what I thought my life would look like. So there's a lot of adjustment going on in general, as there is for all of us.
I feel that. Well, speaking of psychological challenges, we have a question. Oh, no, wait. You have a short poem for us.
I do. I have a stanza of a longer poem, but yes.
Okay.
Okay. Just, like, go at it?
Do it. Hit me.
So this is a medieval a poet. He was born in the middle of the 12th century. His name is Per Vidal. And when I read this particular poem and this stanza, it reminded me of one of my favorite musicians, Morrissey, and you will see from the final line why that is so. This is translated by Paul Blackburn. Lady, when I was within your hall, it seemed St. Julian must have been my host. God never made such a perfect day as you formed of that day with your hand. In your making, he made no mistake. Such arms were cast only to kill me, sure. I trust your excellence is too good a thing, but even if you killed me, it'd be my honor, and if I died, I could only die praising and rejoicing.
Mm.
The Morrissey lyric, to die by your side is such a heavenly way to die, is what I thought of when I read that medieval poem.
Yeah, things have not changed.
Exactly.
I mean, things have changed, but as far as like overly saccharine love poetry, we're still going at it.
Oh yeah, in terms of painful love, not much has changed in the last 800 years or so.
Well, in terms of painful love, or in this case, painful non-love, this question comes at us from Lindsay, who asks, "Dear Hank and Mayim, I recently asked one of my friends to prom. She's a year younger than me, and I wanted to carry on my tradition in my friend circle of bringing underclassmen to prom a year early so they can experience it. Unfortunately, she took my promposal to mean that I had a romantic interest in her, which I don't. She has confessed that she likes me too, and I don't know how to deal with this. Do I tell her that I'm not interested and have the most awkward prom ever, or do I just not break the facade and let her down later? Dubious advice is much appreciated. With much uncertainty, Lindsay." Ay, ay, ay. I don't know. I felt like you were going to have the answer, Maya.
Oh, I have the answer. Is it my turn to say it?
Yeah.
I'm always going to advocate for honest and sincere conversations, even if it hurts other people. And it's never too young to start doing that kindly and lovingly.
Yeah. Yeah, so how do you do this kindly and lovingly? Is it sort of like, okay, here, Lindsay, I asked this question to a podcast, they have answered it, and I would like you to listen to the podcast so that we don't have to have this awkward conversation? That seems like a good way to do it.
I think that that's pretty much the way you have to do it. There's no way to soften the blow of reality in this case, and it's going to hurt her, and I think a lot of people avoid having honest and sincere conversations because they're trying to take care of other people's feelings. And I feel like it creates an environment where no one is able to be honest or deal with their feelings. Yeah. So this gets to be the first experience where that's the conversation. It seems that my promposal, fancy word, it seems that my promposal may have introduced a conversation that is really hard to have, but I really want to go to prom with you, but I'm not romantically interested in you, and I hope that we can still go and have a good time, and if you don't want to, I'll understand.
And I don't know if there's a good hug that can come along with it that isn't awkward, but it does seem like a moment that requires a hug.
I wouldn't want a hug in that situation.
Okay, well, that's good to note.
Yeah. "Dear Hank and Mayim, I'm currently in the middle of getting divorced. For the most part, everything is amicable, and we have both moved on with our lives over this past year. We do have a wonderful 3-year-old son together. My ex-husband's birthday is usually the same week as Father's Day, and I'm not really sure what, if anything, I should do. I would like my son to be able to give his dad a gift, but I can't just give a 3-year-old cash and send him to the store. Should I buy a gift for my ex-husband or invest time in making a craft with my son to give him? Is this my job at all now that we were separated? Should I just assume his new significant other will take this over? As always, dubious advice is appreciated. Thank you, Kat."
Oh,
Kat,
yeah.
I have been in this exact situation.
I mean,
That's why I like this question.
I have feelings. Like, it seems like you ended this amicably and you're still friends. So, like, he's still a father and it's still his birthday and he's still a part of your life.
Right. And I would say my ex's birthday is not the same week as Father's Day, but there are other holidays that fall around my ex's birthday. So this is something that has been in my head a lot. Here's my thing. We get to teach children how to behave, separate from our relationships and our resentments or issues. The fact that it's the same week as Father's Day, I think would be really nice to show your child, whether the father has a new life, to show the child, this is how we celebrate Dad on Father's Day and his birthday. And you don't need to go over the top. I think the first year after we were divorced, I was like, let's buy him a computer. and my therapist was like, no, you don't need to buy him a computer. But I think making cards, having the child decorate a card, is always a nice thing. When I had children that age and I was just divorced, I would have my child say nice things about Daddy. Like, I would say, what's something you like about Daddy? And I would sort of transcribe, Daddy, whatever, gives me candy or whatever it is, and then have them decorate the card. I think that's nice. And if there's something small as a gesture that the child can participate in wrapping, I think it's important to show we give important people gifts. And it really is, it's the ultimate gift to teach that child that while giving the ex-husband a gift.
Boom. You're really good at this. You are better at advice than John
thanks.
And Hank Green are, for sure. I feel like we are dispensing actual good advice on this episode of Dear Hank and John. It's super off-brand.
Sorry.
So to turn things around, I'm going to hit a question from Stephen, who asks, Dear Hank and Mayim, something that I've been wondering for years, what is the clothes fastener technology in Star Wars? Do they have zippers or Velcro, or did all species use the same? Pimento in your eye, Stephen, in Cincinnati. So
I'm going to let you take this one first.
Are you a Star Wars fan? I can't imagine you're not a Star Wars fan.
I am a Star Wars fan.
But did you, upon reading this question, go and Google like every costume design from all of Star Wars? Because that's what I did.
No. I didn't do prep. I don't know if that's what I was supposed to do. No. I didn't do prep. I just used my brain, thought about it.
Yeah, I did a little bit of prep, and I'll say that they seem to use everything. They seem to have Velcro,
yes.
They seem to have even magnetic fasteners, it looks like, on a couple
Love
of
that.
Uniforms. Some you know those belts that like the straps on like backpacks? A couple of those show up.
Right.
But then you have zippers and you have buttons all over the place. Lots of zippers and buttons.
I think, you know,
just like
I
normal
think,
life.
But unlike normal life, I think there's a lot of hidden zippers.
Yeah. Well, that's a costume design thing in general. It's like when you
Correct.
Don't necessarily want a zipper poppet like shit. So I think there's a lot of like the fabric goes over where the zipper is, because otherwise there's no
Correct.
Way to put that shirt on. So you know there's
no,
a zipper
and it doesn't,
there, but you can't
it doesn't,
see.
It just doesn't look as nice. I mean, then you yeah. can't use a Mickey Mouse zipper pull, which is what used to be on one of my favorite jackets.
I mean, I think zipper pulls are so we need a solution to the zipper pull crisis. Zipper pulls have gotten so boring. All my hoodies have normal zipper pulls, and they're just like, they're from, you know, YKK, which is the biggest, you know, they make 90% of the zippers in the world. And I think that there should be a way for me to replace my YKK zipper pulls with something a little more interesting. And
I just attach things to the zipper is my solution.
So you put something on the end of the zipper pull.
Yeah, so like I used to have this is not an advertisement for Mickey Mouse or Disney, but I used to have a Mickey Mouse, it would clip onto your zipper so that you could grab Mickey's face and pull that up. So I took to doing that because that's what people like me do. I would attach like a cute little tie or something like that, and it's easier to do then and cuter.
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole assembly, there should be a way to replace it. If you can't hear me well, it's because I'm examining my hoodie zipper right now. I did a bunch of research on the company that makes YKK, the company that makes like every zipper in the world, and it's amazing. It's an amazing company and like fascinating history. But anyway, do that yourself. That's not what this podcast is about. But I do like I have had this thought several times in the last couple of years that like zipper pulls are an opportunity that we're missing. Is all
to agreed?
Yeah,
agreed.
Like, belt buckles had this for a little while. Socks are having it right now, where people are expressing themselves through their socks in a way they hadn't previously. Of course,
that's true.
Yeah, you know, like, enamel pins are happening. But I think that zipper pulls may be the I'm going to predict right now. Zipper pulls are the next big thing in personal expression for nerds like us.
you heard it here first, folks.
Hank Green, fashion expert. I think that this is obviously this is a galaxy that's very far away. It was a long time ago, but I think that this is a case of just convergent, fastening technology. Like, it's just going to happen that these are the things that work well. Velcro, straps and belts and zippers and buttons and magnetic snaps.
Absolutely.
All right. Do you have another one for us?
Yes, and actually, if you're here's a little hint as to which one I'm going to ask. If you're having a cold, you may want to eat something spicy. Dear Hank and Mayim, my boss keeps asking me things like, "Are you Kim Jong-un's cousin?" Or, "Did you bring dog meat for lunch?"
Oh God!
This is obviously a harmless joke, but I hate it.
Is it?
I'm the only.
Is it a harmless joke?
Wait, well, let's see what the question is.
Okay.
I'm the only Asian working in a building of about 200 white people. So when I first started, I cracked some jokes about being Asian to make everyone feel comfortable with me. But now, a year later, my boss's daily racially centered banter is getting old, annoying, and at times mean. Should I say something to stop her? I feel like if I do, she won't know how else to communicate with me. Also, I feel like it's kind of my fault for starting it. Any advice? Kimchi and Vegemite, Sam.
Oi. First of all, I guess I'm understanding now. So you've got 200 white people in this building. Your direct report boss is thinks that you know, your race is a thing to comment upon, like the color of your shirt. But worse than that, way worse than that. I don't like. So the thing is, this boss is obviously not the top boss at your company. 200 people, you have an HR department, and this is what the HR department is for. When you have a when there's a problem with your boss that doesn't have anything to do with your job, that's who you're supposed to talk to. And that is the kind of exact kind of problem that they want to hear about, because it is a huge, like, it's a pretty big deal.
Mm-hmm. And also, I think what's really interesting, I feel like it's kind of my fault for starting it. Mm-hmm. Let's not go down that road. There's no excuse for what's going on. It is not your fault for starting it, unless by starting it, you mean being Asian.
I mean, it's interesting that coming into a place where you are different, there's often a sort of psychological desire to be like, hey, I know, I'm aware that I'm different, and here it is, I'm Asian, and here's my joke about how I'm a different person, and like trying to like a little bit alleviate the tension of the difference that's there.
I have, as a Jewish person, I've absolutely done this. I've absolutely, when I'm in a situation where it is clear that people are either unfamiliar with Jewish people or have not had a lot of interaction with Jewish people, there is a little bit of kind of social icebreaking you do, mm-hmm. as it were. I mean, I would never say like, how do you like my hook nose or anything like that. And anything that I would say would not be acceptable for that to open the door to people saying, oh, are you never going to buy lunch or anything like that. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that has a huge difference between those two things. Calling it out and being like, I'm aware that I'm different. And then someone else being like, yes, you are. Let me reemphasize that every day for the rest of the time that you work here. Because that was fun when you did it. Oh, man.
No, not okay. And, you know, a really, really important, kind of 21st century realization, these kind of things don't have to be brushed under the rug anymore. You know, a lot of the explosion of, the notion of equality and liberalism, a lot of that sometimes is taken too far. But my feeling is, let's err on the side of being sensitive, cautious, and respectful.
Yeah. Oh, man. It's very weird when people are like, oh, God, I have to think about that now. And I'm just like, well, you know, if you want to be nice, like if you want to be, you know, if you want to respect other humans who are different from you, sure. So I'm so sorry that it's inconvenient, I guess.
Don't put a question mark.
I deal with this a lot in my professional life because I have a science show on YouTube where people are like, they're familiar with people who are like them mostly. And they are, and like the vast majority of SciShow viewers are white dudes. And they, you know, it's difficult to understand the experience of other people. And maybe they're not experienced at it. And when they're like, why did you talk that way? I'm like, well, because I have trans friends who are like, it's better, like it's less troubling for me when you talk a certain way, when you don't connect biological sex and gender. And I'm like, oh, okay, well then I won't do that. And then people, and then like somebody who this doesn't affect at all starts just screaming at me like I have caused the greatest injustice in human history by acknowledging the existence of trans people. And I'm like, I don't know where to go from here. Like, why are you so mad? I didn't tell you how to talk. I talked the way that I thought was respectful to the people that have talked to me about this issue. And I totally lost on that. And I wanted to say it out loud because I've been I've been experiencing it for the last 2 years, and I didn't really talk about it until recently, and I started talking about it to the SciShow audience, and it has been, I feel like, better for everybody to have it a little bit out in the open. So,
agreed.
Anyhow, this question is from Rachel, who asks, "Dear brothers from a mother with a last name of another color," that's a reference to a song I wrote a long time ago, but unfortunately it's not applicable in this situation, unless Bialik is a color.
Actually, it is from the root of the word white. Yes, from the Bialystok region of Russia, Ukraine, Poland.
Hey! But we're not, yeah, unfortunately.
Amazing. Amazing.
Perfect. Excellent. It's siblings, at least. Rachel asks, "I was playing a game of French toast online with friends and that I met at NerdCon Nerdfighteria. Thanks for that, by the way. And we stumbled upon a problem that is threatening to rip us apart. Is a necktie a type of scarf?"
In all caps.
God. Ah. I mean, I don't even want to look at the rest of this question. It's very long. There's a substantial amount of discussion of what a scarf is that continues here. Can we just get beyond needing to label everything to know what things go in what category, and people being like, "Pop-Tarts are sandwiches," and I'm like, stop it, just go away.
Okay, but Rachel wants to know. I want you to tell her.
Mayim, is a Pop-Tart a sandwich? Because it's basically two pieces of bread with something in the middle.
No.
No? You're not ready to accept that?
It's not.
What makes it not a sandwich, then?
Like, you and me hugging someone in the middle of us doesn't make us a sandwich either.
Well, but it's food. It's two pieces of bread.
No. No, but this is like the transitive property of our existence.
Okay. Well,
we're food to someone or some animal.
That'd be good. To a shark, three people hugging is a sandwich. Perfect.
Done. That shark is going to call it a Pop-Tart is what they're going to call it.
So if a Pop-Tart is not a sandwich, then a necktie is not a scarf. Okay.
My feeling is the fact that the word tie is in the name of it means it's not a scarf. It's got the word tie. That's like a verb. It's a thing you do with it.
But, oh God, now we're in the rabbit hole because you could tie a scarf. I've done it.
You could.
No, I do it.
But it's not called a scarf tie.
But when I...
You can also knot... Wait, you can also knot it.
But you can knot... You can knot a tie.
You can wear a scarf as a hat. You can't wear a necktie as a hat.
Oh, my God. That's not helpful. That is not...
My
that was
mother
not involved...
My mother used to, make me wear headbands made out of vintage ties. It was like a thing.
I think I can picture Blossom doing that.
Exactly. She also would give me, I would wear neckties like belts. And when I would be like, "Mom, I don't think this is cool," she'd be like, "Gene Kelly did it." That's a true story.
Oh, so is the necktie a belt is the next question.
Everything is everything.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yes. Okay. Well, you know what? I think it's up in the air, honestly. Rachel, I think we're not going to get there. There comes a point at which things blend, and there is no definite definition of what a sandwich is or what a scarf is, and we're just going to have to accept that there are these areas where there will be disagreement. Like, some people will say that color is orange, and some people will say that color is red because it's right between red and orange. And that's part of life. And you're going to...
And also, this is going to vary culturally as well, right?
Sure.
We have a culture with a language that has names for ascots and ties and bow ties and scarves. And I'm sure there are other things I don't know the names for that are related to things that go around your neck. But we only have one word for snow, right?
No, you clearly don't live in Montana. We have lots of words for snow.
All right. I stand corrected.
Oh man. Well, I feel like I asked that question just to get mad at Rachel, but I'm not really mad
Clearly.
At Rachel. I'm mad at Rachel for letting this come between her and her friends. Like, don't let this tear you apart.
like you could tear apart a necktie after tying it.
Right. Just rip it off. Just rip the whole controversy apart and say, we share values and we share a connection and we share experiences, and that's what ties us together. Not this stupid piece of silk or other kind of fabric.
Okay.
You want to hit me with another question?
I do. I'm really excited about this one, both for you and for me.
Okay.
Thomas says, "Dear Mayim and Hank," oh, I love this question so much. "At the time of writing this, I've just arrived at my favorite place to go and relax, my local library. While the library is awesome for my de-stressification needs, being quiet and peaceful, it is currently packed with shouting babies and their equally loud mothers on account of it being, according to the website, baby time." Wait for it. I'm going to ask it the way I would ask it. How is this a thing? If there's one thing everyone learns about libraries, is that they're supposed to be quiet. How do you two feel about this? Should baby time be a thing? Also, should I get another quiet place during the weekly shouting match between tiny humans that seems to be taking place? Coffee and rage, Thomas. Thomas, are you single? Because you are absolutely the person for me. I am a mother. I'm a mother of two children, and this stuff makes me bonkers. Makes me bonkers.
I live in a town that is very baby and child friendly, and like the owners of businesses are aware that in order to fill out their clientele, they have to appeal to parents and get them out of the house and get them going to places. And so in my pre-baby life, like, I haven't gotten to the point where I can even do this yet because my child sleeps every 30 seconds and we don't want to mess with it. He's just like, at this age, at 6 months, they're all like, it's always either about, like, they're just getting up or they're about to go to sleep. There's like 30 minutes during which you can do stuff. It's very frustrating. But eventually, I imagine this will happen. But before, in my pre-baby life, I would show up at a bar, and then suddenly it would be like a person would be on the stage singing children's music, and 1,000 children would be running around screaming, and it would be all, and I was just like, I came to a bar! I came to a bar to do bar things, and suddenly I found myself in what is apparently like a bar gymboree. Like, it's as if the McDonald's playpen.
It's a barberie.
Yeah, got it on with a regular dive bar in Missoula, Montana that smells like cigarettes and a century of beer poured across the floorboards. This is not normal.
No. But it is a thing.
But I mean, like, it's great. I'm happy now that, like, there will be a future in which I can take my 3-year-old screaming pile of annoyance to a bar and have a beer.
So I literally could probably do an hour podcast by myself about this very topic, because I think here's the thing. And I live in Los Angeles, which is, you know, kind of the ultimate in accommodating the baby culture. I think that there's a couple things that are going on, and one of the things, and, you know, as a person who advocates for natural birth, and I'm a lactation educator counselor, and a lot of my world kind of revolves around people honoring the natural rhythms of babies and children, I think that there's this notion that, you know, life shouldn't change or can't change, and we have all of these activities and things that you can do to try and prove to yourself, you know, that life doesn't have to change just because you have kids. So, you know, you can take your baby to yoga, and they have movie theaters where they turn the lights down, but not all the way. And everyone's encouraged to bring their children so their children can run around the theater and you can all go to the movies with your children still there. Or there's a restaurant here, and, you know, no judgment against people who want to use it. The restaurant has a separate back room with hired babysitters, and you drop your children off so you can have a fancy Beverly Hills lunch while a stranger watches your children.
Well, a qualified stranger, theoretically.
Sure. But then, again, for me, the overarching notion here is, how can you get back to your life as soon as possible? And for a lot of people, I understand that's a valuable priority. But as a person who, again, advocates for really living in rhythm with the small mammal that you have ricocheted out of your body, it is also okay to acknowledge that your life is going to change.
Yeah.
And that tension is what makes us human, and it's what makes us able to accommodate the changes in our body, the changes in our culture. It doesn't all have to be the same. Mm-hmm. So obviously, Thomas may have to find another time. He's welcome to gently tell the head of the library or the HR department at the library that this seems an odd choice of a place to do baby time. But I'm the kind of person, I love my kids, not so keen on other people's kids because I can't control them and I can't control the way people parent them. When I go to grown-up restaurants with my children, I always go at the earliest reservation time. I ask to be seated quickly, I order quickly, and I get out of there. Because not everyone has to like being with my children in a grown-up restaurant. Yeah. And there were about 2 years when my ex and I didn't really go out to restaurants. We cooked, we ordered in, we had people bring us food, because we didn't feel like it was other people's responsibility to tolerate us wanting to feel normal again. We made a decision to have a baby. Maybe we dealt with it the way we felt was most appropriate for society at large. And so, Thomas, I share your rage, and I absolutely am holding your hand through this whole thing.
So I think that your arguments here are completely valid for, like, the Barbary movie theater restaurant with a nursery in the back kind of situation where people are like, I had children, but I don't want to have had children, and so I want to have my normal life. How, like, and I have a lot of money to spend trying to pretend for a moment that I just, it's just me and my wife again. And I understand that. And I understand, like, wanting to, like, do that sometimes, and, like, but I think that there's a difference between that and, like, what I'm struggling with right now is, like, I would like to meet some people who have six-month-old babies so that, like, we can talk about, like, what they're doing and commiserate and be like, you're doing great, and just, like, and be like, someday our kids maybe are going to go to school together. And I think that that's the purpose of baby time at the library. Like, it's not like, you know, it's not like these parents would be going to the library. They're not going to the library to use the library while their babies are there. They're going, it's like an event for parents to meet each other. And libraries are, in addition to being providing the service of, you know, available media for you to acquire temporarily, they're also community organizing and event spaces. And it would be nice if we had more different kinds of community organizing and event spaces, but we kind of just have the library. And libraries want to be a useful thing in the world, and since this is a useful thing, like, so if you think about it that way, maybe it causes a little bit less rage that it's providing a service for your community, but I understand, and it is hard to find other quiet places, and I hope that this doesn't start happening to, like, coffee shops, like, places where, oh, just give me a place where it can be quiet and we can do our thing. And I think there will always be places for you.
But in short, yes, Thomas, this is a thing.
It's a thing. I have another question, Mayim. It's from Ben, who asks, Dear Hank and Mayim, I was opening some boxes at work today and one smelled a little bit like gasoline. I brought up the fact that I enjoy the smell of gasoline with a coworker, and we began talking about how it does seem to be a smell that a lot of people like. Why is that? I understand why evolution would shape our brains to enjoy sweet smells because that indicates, like, sugar or food. I understand why we might dislike the smell of rotting meat or poo because it contains things that could kill us, but why gasoline? If you brought gasoline back to the time when our ancestors lived in Africa 2 million years ago, would they appreciate the smell too? Like, this is a dangerous thing. This is me talking now. Why, like, do not, like, gasoline is, like, it's cancer in a bottle. Like, do not, like, if you huff it, you will die eventually. If you drink it, you will die. But I think and it's clearly not just me, because Ben thinks it too, that gasoline kind of smells good.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love gasoline.
So, I mean, I don't know, like, I did a little bit of research. There's some thought that, like, oh, it's just like it connects you back to your past and it's like a nostalgia thing. But there's also some indication that you like the smell of gasoline more, like you rate it more highly on the pleasantness scale if you are currently hungry, which makes me think that since it's similar molecule to a lot of aromatic molecules that are the things that give, like, fruits their, like, fun smells and good smells. And in this question, Ben talks about sweet smells, but there are no, you can't smell sugar. So Yeah, there are smells that are associated with sweetness because they come along with sweetness, and they tend to be these aromatic hydrocarbons that benzene, which is like the primary thing in gasoline, is sort of shaped similarly to. And so I'm guessing that like there's kind of a, like maybe some similarity there. You know about the brain some.
Well,
right?
Yeah, and I mean I think that I think that for some people, like a lot of sort of, you know, the gasoline research out there in terms of why people like it says that like, oh, you're feeling a small high. You're getting a small high.
And
even if it's not a conscious high, meaning you're not consciously processing like, whoa, this feels, you know, whatever, that you are associating it, on an unconscious level with some sort of euphoria. I noticed one person when answering this question on the interwebs said like, I like gasoline because I associate it with fun, like boats, like jet skis. I don't think for me that's sure. It, but I really, I don't think that I have a death wish, but I like any noxious smell. I like, you know, those magic markers or like the really thick markers that we used to make poster boards for science experiments. Like,
right.
That's just like, I don't know why that's my jam, but it is. I've never passed out from it. I have two children, one of whom really likes that smell, and he's sort of my mini-me genetically, and the other one, who's more his dad genetically, does not like the smell. So I will continue to do this experiment. I'm not having any more children, but wouldn't that have been a great experiment?
Do it, yeah. Well, now you are obligated by science.
To make more babies?
To just pop a few more out, yeah. That's how it works.
Yes.
So basically, though we don't know, but apparently it is a common thing. I didn't realize until I read that question that it wasn't just me. Like I've been kind of quiet about it, experiencing shame.
Right.
I've got this weird thing about me
that I like the smell of this dangerous thing. You love gasoline and you're proud.
Okay. well, let's just throw it in a perfume then.
Yeah.
coming next year, Motocross the scent.
Oh yeah, that's that's pheromonic for sure.
All right, let's hit another question. Okay. This one's from Liza.
Oh, go ahead. It was my turn.
All right.
No.
It is, and I said her name wrong anyway. So you go.
Okay. This is a rough one, but I really want to ask Darcy's question. Dear Hank and Mayim, I would like to preface this email by saying that I am not xenophobic or discriminatory towards religions. I just don't understand the tradition of Islam of women covering themselves. My question is this: how should I feel about headscarves? And do you feel differently about hijabs, niqabs, and burqas? To me, they seem oppressive. I know in many countries, especially in the Middle East, these are used to oppress women as shown in society and law. However, I can appreciate that some people wear them to respect God, but if God made people perfect, and so on, why do we need to cover ourselves like that? Why don't men have to cover heads and faces, specifically in Islam? But in some societies, women are demonized and even killed for not wearing a burqa. Again, not a xenophobe, Darcy. P.S. Is there a term that means discriminatory against religious beliefs? As I know, I use xenophobic incorrectly throughout this email. That's several questions, Darcy.
It is a bunch of questions and a bunch of hard questions.
Yes. Let's tackle them all. Or a couple.
Yeah.
So the reason that this question is so interesting to me is that I come from a religious tradition where women do cover their heads and also parts of their bodies that that often men don't have to cover. And so obviously Islam is different than religious Judaism. But I think one of the main things that sort of strikes me about people's often misunderstandings about religion and also about the restrictions specifically on women is that, you know... We are the interpreters of religious traditions as human beings, and the notion that God has passed down ways for me to cover myself or restrict my freedoms, to me, those really need to be understood in the context of history and the anthropology of parts of the world where these religions originated. So, you know, the laws that we impose on ourselves and on other people are exactly that. They are made by humans, and in most cases, they're made by men. So the notion that women have been restricted in Islam or even in Judaism, the fact is for pretty much all of human history, women have been restricted in a lot of ways. And part of that is biology, you know, as Freud told us, right? Biology is destiny. And to some sense, that's true. But I think it's important to realize that our interpretation is what's important. And the way we understand it in terms of history is important as well. There are restrictions for men, for example, in religious Judaism, in terms of modesty and how they dress. But historically, there have always been differences in the way men and women are treated. Now, I'm not saying that burqas is the way to go. For me, that doesn't work. Or the notion that when girls are, you know, of the age that they start their menstrual cycle, that we cover their heads. In religious Judaism, head covering is seen as a change in status from unmarried to married. And that's sort of how I've grown up framing it. It is very upsetting to see women completely covered. And a lot of women who claim that they're happy that way are also growing up and living in a culture of religious patriarchy. So a lot of times we don't know things are not okay until we see more of the world and understand sort of more of how history is moving forward. So I don't know that there's an easy answer to this. I will say, though, that we shouldn't just demonize religions, because honestly, it's culture in general that has distinguished men and women because of their biology and because then of how culture interprets that. But blaming God is really not the place to go here, because, you know, God, as far as I'm concerned, God's in charge of creating the world, and then we're in charge of being the human beings that try and interpret that and bring meaning to the world in a way that God cannot communicate directly with us.
I feel tremendously unqualified to answer this question, and so I'm glad that you were here today to help with that. The thing that I generally try to remember is that we all do things based on our culture that don't that we think make perfect sense. But if you think about them, they don't really. Like, it would be very weird for me to go leave my house in a sundress. And people would comment upon that, and many people would, you know, if I did that in the wrong place, I would be in a lot of trouble. Like, I would potentially not make it home unscathed in America. And so we have, but I can also say that I prefer to not wear sundresses. Why is that? Probably not because I wouldn't be comfortable in them if I had been raised wearing sundresses. Like, I'd probably be super down with it, and I'd probably look pretty cute. But but the fact that, like, I have grown up in a culture where that is the norm, like, I would never be like, you know, like, this is, like we need to restructure my society to, or even force people to dress a certain way when they have had their life, when they have been told their whole life that, like, you should cover your head. And that is a thing that happens, in lots of different traditions for both genders. You know, Sikhs, for example, like, in public, mm-hmm. always have their heads covered. I get very weirded out when it's like, yes, we should understand that this is a tool of culture, and that it isn't like, and that it is a system that comes out of men trying to control women or succeeding in controlling women. But at the same time, you can't jump mm-hmm. in and tell people that they can't dress a certain way anymore because you're trying to free them, because that is the opposite of freeing them.
Absolutely.
It's a hard one, though. But
I think
it is
we
very
did well.
Important
Between
to,
the two
to,
of us, I think we did yeah. well.
I think it's very important to separate the idea of culture and the idea of religion and know that there are many religious people who do things differently, and many people who feel very free and very liberated and also wear headscarves. Like, and mm-hmm. you know, I have those friends, and they're like, and like, it doesn't even occur to me that their headscarf is like a result of their heritage coming from a patriarchal place, because first of all of our heritage does, and like even now it does, but like they are now, you know, like having their experience of their, you know, their worldview, their religion, their connection, their Americanness, all of the things that inform who they are, it's just that, like, their continuing desire to have dress in the way that they like to dress is a thing, and that's dope. All right, Mayim, I have one more question before we get to the all-important news from Mars and AFC Wimbledon. This one's from Lisa, who asks, "Dear Hank and Mayim, I'm 15 years old and I want to get a summer job. The thing is, I have no idea how to describe myself in a CV. I'm a very awkward and shy person. How did you describe yourself when you were looking for your first job? Dubious advice is welcome. Yours, Lisa." I'll be honest. You just walk into Walmart and you're like, "I would like to stock your shelves." And they'll be like, "Okay, here's $7 an hour," or whatever it is. Like, it's... If you're getting that kind of job, they're happy to give it.
I actually have by CV, I usually think that means sort of like an academic resume of like, you don't usually have to describe yourself in a CV, but I guess maybe she's talking about if there's like an application, it says describe yourself, and she's confused as to how you describe yourself
like
as an awkward and shy person.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I happen to be an introverted person, and to me, I like that term more than awkward and shy. I don't typically say to people, I'm a little bit on the spectrum. I usually say, I'm an extroverted introvert. Here are the things that I excel at. Some of these things are challenges for me. And I'm very, you know, excited/motivated/interested in being able to find a place at your, you know, place where I would like to work.
Yeah. And also, I think that it's important to know that, like, there are a lot of things that you aren't going to be good at because you've never had a job. So you don't exactly know what people want, what this job is and how it works and what you will be doing and what's required of you. But I do think that it's like focusing on strengths, obviously, is the thing that you do in job applications. Can you work when you're 15? Is that allowed?
And also being honest.
Is that allowed? Like, when is the age where you can start working?
Clearly 15. I think 15 in some places, yeah.
14, minimum age for employment in specified occupations outside school hours. 16, basic minimum age for employment. So I don't even know if you can. You gotta be careful, Lisa.
Maybe she's on the cusp. Come on now. Yeah. Let's not get caught up on the details. She's asking a question. She's awkward and shy. How does she describe herself?
Lisa did the right thing by not saying, I'm 15 and 3/4 years old, because that is intolerable. So
she can't win with you. She can't win.
So I appreciate, Lisa, you having done it the way that you've done it. Because obviously summer is coming up and you may be 16 by then. But yeah, I think it's a great thing to get a job at that age and to get a little bit of responsibility and learn what it is to, and maybe, you know, even become a little less awkward and shy as you connect with folks. I'm not saying like stop being introverted, but, you know, being able to, like everything gets better with practice.
Well, and also finding out what you don't like is often as important as finding out what you do. And a very close friend of mine who's a very strong introvert and really, really struggles in social situations, you know, she actually likes working in an office filing things because her actual interaction with people's minimal. She's got the things that she does. She knows how to do them and she does them on time and she goes home. You know, that works for her. So you will also find what works and doesn't work for you as the person that you are and the person that you're supposed to be.
Mm-hmm. And the person that you will be, because of course, remember that we all continue to change. I'm 36 years old. Oh my gosh, I'm going to be 37 really soon. By the time this podcast comes out, I'm going to be 37.
Are you 36 and 3/4?
No, I feel the burn. Oh, somebody get a salve.
Does it smell like gasoline or burning rubber? Because I know you like it.
Oh, man.
Woof. Jeez.
this podcast is brought to you by Sick Burns. Don't do it. Don't put yourself in a situation where Mayim Bialik's going to get you, because she will.
Says every man I've ever dated. This podcast has been brought to you by Shark Sandwich, also known as Three People Hugging.
Oh, delicious, delicious. So everything is a sandwich. If there's three things and you've put them next to each other, if you could conceivably think of a situation in which something might consume those things, it's a sandwich. This podcast is also brought to you by Mickey Mouse zipper pulls. Absolutely adorable on young Mayim Bialik, who is also wearing a necktie as a belt like Gene Kelly.
This podcast is brought to you by child labor laws. Helping you figure out how far through a year you are allowed to apply for a job in.
You show up and you're like, hello, I'm 15 and three quarters, and I would like a job here at Walmart. And they'll be like, absolutely. Let us begin the application process. Well, now it is time for the all-important news from Mars and AFC Wimbledon. I have heard that there is news from AFC Wimbledon, and I want to hear it.
Oh, man. The goalkeeper shock is what's happening. Yeah. Yeah.
A legend midfielder
has been let go. Yeah.
So both the goalkeeper... So what's the goalkeeper shock?
So first, James Shea is leaving. But now, Danny Bowman and Chris Robertson are also leaving Kingsmeadow.
Oh, my gosh.
I know.
Oh, man.
And, you know, there are tough decisions to make. And, you know, there have been over 100 appearances in all competitions for this club between Bowman and Shea. But, you know, unfortunately, what Neil Ardley has said, he's the boss, he said, we've reached a point where finances and different things go on. And with a heavy heart, we have to let Danny go. And
it is such a bummer.
It's a bummer.
When finance and different things
go on. Different things. And especially with a player like Danny, because they have such strong allegiances with him. He's never let them down. Never let them down. But finances and things, you know, have really gotten in the way. People are going to miss him. And he's really been a step-up kind of player. His attitude, they say, is a model for... I mean, he sounds like the perfect guy, but as I said, finances and different things.
that's a bummer. I mean, John is going to be so sad that he wasn't here to deliver that news. It's probably so sad enough that he's going to deliver it again next week.
Oh, yeah.
But
no,
it's so
tragic. I mean, it's a shock. Palpable shock.
I am pleased that you were here to give that news, because... I think I enjoyed it more than I would have if John had delivered it.
I'm still reeling. I'm just reeling.
I mean, aren't we all? And I'm sure that everybody out there who's listening to the pod is, gently weeping into their car steering wheels or wherever you happen to be. Drive safe, everyone. And don't forget, if you put something in the oven, it's probably on fire by now, because we did such a good job of distracting you. The news from Mars... is good and bad, Mayim. In the next, right now, we have 9 operating missions on or around Mars. So we've got rovers, we've got orbiters. This is a lot. There's a lot happening all at the same time. It's more than ever. But in 2020, we're going to have 9 more missions. We're going to double the number of missions that are headed to Mars. We've got SpaceX. We've got, we've got SpaceX, we've got the Mars 2020 rover, we've got the European Space Agency's ExoMars mission, we've got China's thing, we've got the United Arab Emirates Hope Orbiter, we've got India's Mars Orbiter 2. There's a lot happening, and this is great, this is very exciting, but we only have one way to communicate between Mars and Earth. We've got this deep space network that NASA set up, and it lets all other, space agencies piggyback on it. But it can only handle so much data, and you need a lot of data, not just for sending back pretty pictures and spectroscopy stuff, but also just to figure out telemetry and know where everything is and keep things in the right orbit and make sure they land in the right place and keeping them moving around on the surface of the planet. And it's gonna start getting overloaded to the point where people are legitimately concerned about whether we will have too many Mars missions if they all make it, which we know we're all hoping they do, that we won't have enough bandwidth to manage the amount of data that we need just to keep the missions running, not even including sending back, beautiful high-resolution images and videos. So caution to the world, we need a more robust deep space network.
This sounds like something someone should have thought about before you and me saying it right now, but you're absolutely right.
All these missions happened really quick. They're happening faster. People are designing the missions more quickly. SpaceX is like, we're gonna land a lander on Mars in 2020, and you're like, what? It's 2017, you guys. That's not long from now. So we're getting better at doing it fast, and Yeah. So this is a thing that we needed to think about, and thankfully people are starting to think about it, and I'm sure they'll, you know, that's the thing about NASA, like, they see problems coming pretty long way away. They're going to figure it out.
I'm hopeful.
They're going to figure it out. I'm hopeful. We're all hopeful. Mayim, this has been an absolute joy. You're really good at this.
Thank you. I mean, I learned most things I know from you, so thank you.
Oh, that's definitely not the case.
At least in this arena it is.
Right, sure, maybe. In terms of advice podcasts, but I appreciate you taking the time out of your day to spend time. And if you want to check out Mayim,
well, thank you for the faith in me to allow me to participate in this. This was awesome.
Well, if you want to check out some of the other cool stuff Mayim is doing, her website is Grok Nation, GROK Nation. And if you want to check out more of what's going on with Dear Hank and John, you can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/DearHankandJohn. We're not doing a This Week in Rhymes because Mayim doesn't have any idea what that is. And I don't want to throw her that deep into the deep end, but there will be another one next week when John comes back. So we appreciate all of you hanging out. This podcast is edited by Nicholas Jenkins. Rosianna Hulse-Rojas and Sheridan Gibson are our producers. Victoria Bongiorno is our social media manager. Theme music is from Gunnarola, and I think I said all the things. I usually write it down beforehand, and honestly, John mostly handles this part, so I forget how it goes. You can email us your questions at hankandjohn@gmail.com. And as we say in our hometown, don't forget to be awesome.